Hello and welcome to the Green Room Golf Course podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. Thanks for listening to this podcast, which sheds a light upon the golf industry and what it takes to maintain a modern course. I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Carl Hansel, and I'd like to welcome you to this Continue to Learn Extra podcast, where we'll be discussing conservation and its place in a post-COVID world. You almost certainly won't recognise my voice as being the host of the Green Room Golf Course podcast from Bigger, while I'm also the editor of Greenkeeper International, so apologies for that too. Please note, this is a pre-recorded webinar because we couldn't trust James not to start swearing. And there might be kids listening in. With that in mind, if you've got any questions for either of our panelists, you won't be able to ask them whilst you're watching this, but I will get them to tell you their contact details at the end of the webinar, or you can just Google them yourselves, because I'm sure they're easily searchable. There's a distinctly northern feel to this webinar, so apologies in advance to anyone south of the Wirral or north of Scarborough, for my own accent and for the soft, dulcet tones of our two distinguished guests, who are Bigger's James Hutchinson and Warrington Golf Club course manager, John McLaughlin. Welcome, gents.
Hi, Carl.
How are you doing? James is an RNA gold badge holder. He was previously environmental officer at St Andrews, and prior to that, he was ecology manager at Fairhaven Golf Club in Lancashire. In his role as Membership Services Manager responsible for ecology and sustainability at Bigger, he provides an amazing service for our members, visiting their courses to learn about what environmental practices they put in place and he also offers ideas and suggestions to help improve their environmental footprint. He's visited hundreds of golf courses and is always on the lookout for the next rare orchid or dandelion. John McLaughlin is course manager at Warrington Golf Club and is about as switched on as it comes when talking about ecology. Unlike myself and James, he's not too bad with a golf club in his hands, but it's in greenkeeping that he's really shone. At the start of this year, John and the Warrington team were announced as winners of the Golf Environment Awards Golf Course of the Year top prize. Some of the work the team at Warrington does includes composting of all green waste, and they've also introduced beehives and wildflower areas to the course. James and I were both at the Golf Environment Awards this year, but we always get sat right at the back in the cheap seats. How was the view from the stage, John? What's it like up there?
Yeah, it was our third year at the awards, and every single year they seem to be getting bigger and bigger, and I think there was almost 180 people this year, which was a record for the awards. And as I say, yeah, it seems to be growing, and the awareness of ecology seems to be growing in the industry, which is a great thing, and sort of it's getting a bigger accolade to win every year now, and I think that'll be the case going forward over the next sort of next 10 years or so. It sort of it'll continue to be a great thing to win and put the golf clubs that do win it in at the forefront of environmental practices.
Yeah, brilliant. Congratulations on that. I don't know if I've had a chance to say, but yeah, absolutely amazing effort from yourself.
Thanks.
And I know James echoes that.
Before
we get cracking on the main body of the webinar, and like I said, we're going to discuss conservation in this world, this coronavirus world we found ourselves. I did want to reflect a little bit on the pandemic we've just been through in another sense. James, I mentioned you're responsible for ecology and sustainability at Bigger, and the association made the difficult decision back when this first started, that with no national travel allowed and only the most limited maintenance taking place on golf clubs, you were asked to sit on the bench for a few months. You were furloughed. I should say that this week you're back with us in official capacity, and it's been great to see. But on a personal level, how did you find that experience of being furloughed? Was it tough? Was it difficult? You've got a lovely tan.
Oh, thank you very much. On a personal level, it was. I've always been in work. I've never not done work. I've never not gone to work. So, the first week it was like a little bit of a holiday. I'll be honest with you, getting paid to sit at home and do nothing. So the paintbrush came out. The garden's immaculate. The first week, second week, as well. But as the time went on, it starts. You know, you start to think things. Am I ever going back to work? When will we go back to work? What am I going to do? Am I going back to work? Am I allowed to travel when I go back to work? So there's so many variables to take into account when thinking about working from home. Well, being from home. You get used to it in the end. But it's a little bit of a shock.
How have you found being back to work this week?
I've enjoyed it. And I actually feel like I just slipped straight back into it. Visited a few golf courses. A couple of visits down the motorway and what have you. And yeah, I felt like I slipped straight back into it. So I'm raring to go again next week. But as you say, back on furlough until who knows when.
So we can get you some business, isn't it? Those golf courses. John, did you have to furlough members of your staff? What's it been like at your spot?
Yeah, so for 7 weeks, we just had the course manager, myself, the deputy course manager, and first assistant working. So for the majority of the 8 weeks lockdown, there was only three members of the team working, and the other five were furloughed. But obviously, with taking in the flags and not raking bunkers and stuff, it was actually... With a lot of people, apart from the key workers, stuck inside, it was actually quite nice to be going into work with no golfers. And I was starting at 9 o'clock, finishing at 4 or 5 o'clock. So it was actually quite. It's wrong to say I enjoyed it during a pandemic, but I actually did enjoy it. So it was nice to be getting out the house, not having just the 1 hour to get out and enjoy the golf course and the surroundings. It was quiet. It was quite tranquil. There wasn't a lot of staff, so there wasn't a lot of instructions to be given out. So I was back mowing. I don't do an awful lot of mowing these days, so I was back mowing fairways, mowing tees, mowing greens. So I used that time to... Again, listen to a lot of podcasts. I got myself some new Bluetooth noise cancelling headphones. So listen to some of your podcasts, Carl. Listen to a lot of other podcasts, some not even in golf. So I used that time, hopefully really well, to sort of educate myself and upskill while obviously it was a negative situation. So yeah, I'd say... and made the most of it and learned as much as I could by using the opportunity of knuckling down working and listening to some really good information.
Oh, so you're the one though. You're the one. I wondered who it was that actually listened. with so many of your team actually furloughed, what was your relationship with them during that time and ongoing, of course? Now, have you stayed in contact with them?
Yeah, so we sort of like to update them sort of weekly, bi-weekly, to let them know what's going on within the month in hand. So all the staff were really keen to come back to work. None of them really, they all were desperate to come back. None of them enjoyed being off, so we're very lucky in that sense. But they all sort of kept themselves busy gardening and, as you say, painting like James. So... it was a shock. It was a shock to their system. But since the start, we've now got five staff back in, and we're bringing another member of the team back next week. So there'll be six, and still two furloughed. So with the club still unsure of sort of financially how this is going to impact the club, so that we're still acting cautious and still sort of making sure we can try and balance the books as best we can by the end of the year. So
was your course open to the public during the pandemic?
We do have a public footpath that goes through the course, which we do normally sort of patrol. If anyone walks, you know, onto the course and veers off the footpath, we do normally sort of tell people to the rules and regulations about sticking to the footpath. But during the pandemic, we were quite liberal and we didn't mind local residents. We have a lot of properties that back onto the course. So we did have a lot of dog walkers and a lot of cyclists and walkers, but we took sort of a liberal approach. They were doing no harm, and it was actually, with us all sort of working individually, it was actually quite nice seeing people now and again walking around. So we sort of did relax the approach, and a lot of the local residents, it was sort of, it kept them active and getting out. So we were quite happy that we could sort of play a part in that of people's well-being.
Brilliant, good on you. Did you see an increase in wildlife around the course over that period?
Yeah, it was, definitely, in sort of different in instances. The crows and magpies, I've never seen as many, really. And obviously there's, with the restrictions to do with leather jackets and insecticides, the sort of crows quadrupled, really, and they're pecking a lot of the fairways and making the most of the course being quiet, same as the magpies. They were on doing a lot of pecking, but also we're getting a lot of starlings coming on the course, which was nice. We don't normally see lots of starlings and stuff, but obviously we saw a massive increase in starlings, and a lot of bird life sort of did really sort of, when you're out on the course on your own, you sort of do notice these things. And there was a massive increase in bird life with the amount of golfers not being on. Obviously there was herons coming on a lot and feeding on all the ponds that we've got, which they obviously get scared off a lot with golfers and constant foot flow. So it was nice to see the uplift in the wildlife.
Brilliant. I think, John, it's always been said that if you do want to see wildlife, or you want to take a photograph of wildlife, then just sit still, find some woodland and just sit there and see what comes. It's only when we get involved and start to play golf and start the machinery up where the wildlife just disappears back into the woodland. So, yeah. It makes sense that you see more.
Yes, it was definitely noticeable, and that was obviously one of the positives that I suppose has come of the lockdown, is the balance in nature that's been brought from this.
Only when we get involved, it goes out of sync.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how do you keep that going when restrictions are lifted, etc., no golfers are back on the course? How do you keep that positivity and keep the course attractive for wildlife?
Well, I think it's actually played into our hands, really, and sometimes it's less is more. So as James touched on then, the less interference you can do is sometimes the better. So with the restrictions and following the guidelines with the RNA with regards to mowing rough and leaving carries and non-essential areas, our grasslands have increased dramatically on the course over this year. We were bringing a lot of them in anyway, but certainly with having such low staff numbers, we have again increased some of our carries. We brought in a lot of the rough, and normally this could have being a contentious issue with some of the members, but obviously following the guidelines, we weren't allowed to cut a lot of these areas. So it sort of played into our hands that we could naturalise a lot of areas, a lot of tees that might have been fly mowed and manicured around. We've naturalised these areas, which we'd almost wanted to do for a long time, and I think the course looks better for it. So, less is something more. So,
totally agree, John. You mentioned naturalised then. When I go to a golf course and if I see them totally manicured, then I always suggest just leave some bramble, leave some scrub, leave some long grass, let it grow. That's how you'll get the wildlife there. The wildlife doesn't live on the manicured tees and the fairways. We know this, so just let it grow. Unless you've got Japanese knotweed or giant hogweed or anything like this growing, then leave it to its own devices. That's how you get the nature there.
Yeah, so that's happened, and it's been good. Normally, with growing in some of these roughs and tightening up the course and some of the carries, we'd normally have had, I would suggest, half a dozen emails or so with people complaining that we're trying to make the course too tough and people wanting to know the reasons for this, where people have accepted it straight away. There's been no negative comments. People understand we're still running on sort of 25% less staff on the course. So it's been a good way to bring in some of these changes which will benefit the wildlife and the overall sustainability of the site, because we're not burning as much diesel cutting these areas now. Which is a positive.
Are these things that you've had to do during the essential maintenance period that you think will stick now for some time?
Yeah, well, we'll definitely get through the rest of this year with what we've put in place, and then we will then have to maybe relook at these sort of next spring. But for the majority of this year, yeah, I think we could be low staff numbers until October potentially. So to start cutting long rough that we were not allowed to cut to following the guidelines is not going to be top of our priority list, really. We were going to be concentrating on fine surfaces, greens and tees and refinements. So it has been nice to be able to sort of implement these changes.
Yeah. Sheep, John, cattle, that's the way forward in the long roughs.
I know. I've always wanted to get sheep on a golf course. It's been one thing that I'm determined to do at some point in my career. So, what's this?
Well, it's totally doable. There was a time you have to fence off the roughs and fence off the greens and everything like that. With modern practices, certainly modern farming now, you can bury a just stick with me on this one, an electric wire around your roof. Put a small charge to it, battery powered charge, and the sheep or the cattle wear an ankle bracelet or tag on their ear. And when they get near the electric wire, it's just a little zap. And the sheep and the cattle, they work the area out where they can and can't go really quick. So it's doable on golf courses now, where years and years ago we used to have to rope fences, fence greens and tees off and so on.
Well, we did actually earlier in the year. We have some farmland backing onto the course, and obviously some of the local farmers brought sheep on to sort of graze over the winter and stuff. And we did actually get some sheep on the course. And once they found the route onto the course, they did come, they knew the way on. And obviously, because we had such nice grasslands on the course, the sheep they'd never been so happy yet. Yeah? They quickly moved off the old farmland and moved onto the course. Although it was just the golfers didn't quite take to it because it was just such a shock to them. But yeah, it's sort of something I've never really thought of, that idea with the underground electric fence. Yeah, I like the idea of that. You give me
you can't have too much of a charge though. Just a little small battery charge, just to let them know it's there.
Yeah.
It's not like Jurassic Park or anything like that. No. Mm-hmm. Fair enough. John, did it help you that you had this reputation of ecology, etc., and letting the grasses grow, you know, rewilding that area? Did it help you during this period in terms of, was your adjustment as big as a course that maybe manicures everywhere? Did you find it easier to transition, you know, to work with fewer staff and to transition into that?
Yeah, well, it's something that we've been working on for the last 2-3 years. Following feedback, we come runners up in the sort of the Ecology Awards a couple of times in Club of the Year. And some of the feedback we did have from the SDRI ecologists with regard to obviously why we haven't won in certain years, was we were almost potentially over manicure in some areas that could be left. So we did sort of, we let grow a hectare of rough last year, which really helped us obviously to win the awards, and that was a sort of the next step that we need to do. I'd say we were a little bit over manicured. So we brought in a Hector last year, and it's just sort of just this year we've just sort of grown on that, really. Some of the areas we maybe didn't get to do, and we refined a few more areas this year. So it was something that we were looking to sort of do anyway, and some areas from last year did need cut back a little bit, and we knew where we could get away with growing more rough. So it's just using the sort of restrictions to our advantage.
Are you finding more wildflowers in those areas, John? The hectare that you've grown in the last couple of years?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. It's not something that we've been particularly conscious of. We do have a number of areas where we have sown wildflowers on the course. Obviously, the areas that we're actually growing is more sort of almost in play areas. But we have been sort of picking the areas that we know where the fine fescues dominate. So if we know that there's areas where there's coarser grasses, we've generally been managing them, and we are dominated by 90% of the site is fine grasses, so especially the roughs. So yeah, we have seen sort of an increase in wildflowers in it, and it is funny because you could say, some people would say, oh, that's a weed, but it's not a weed. It's only a weed if it's not meant to be there. And these areas are wild. So, yeah, so they could be classed as some weeds, but
no such thing as a weed, John.
Exactly. So it's exactly no such thing as a weed. So, definitely been an increase, yeah.
You said, obviously, it's an admirable goal that you started in that hectare as an, because that's what the STRI said, it'd tip you over the edge for the awards. But what was there another additional benefit to that? Are you saving costs, man hours by leaving that area?
Yeah, well, it used to take us 4 or 5 days cutting all the rough at Warrington, which was almost a one person's job for the whole week, cutting rough, and that was with a sort of a 5-gang rough mower. This year we purchased a brand new 7-gang Toro 4700 rough mower. From 2 years ago, it taking us 5 days to cut the rough. We can now cut the rough in 1 day. So the fuel saving that we've made from purchasing obviously the new larger mower and the man hours has been amazing, and that's allowing us to put our time into other aspects of the course. So we only got the new mower at the start of this year, which has made a massive difference to go from a week someone sitting on a mower to 1 day. And that's obviously the mower's bigger, but we've brought in so many areas now. And it's given the course, each hole sort of looks individual now, whereas before, 3-4 years ago, each hole sort of ran into each other. We looked almost like a park where it was cut wall to wall. Now, we had drone footage done last year, and the course just looks so much better than it ever had before, because of each hole was on its own. Even though we've cleared out some of the woodlands, the holes really stand out now, and the heathland feel we're getting now is fantastic.
All right, James, I wanted to ask you, as an expert in all these different conservation, and as somebody who himself was an ecology officer at a golf club before, in a time of coronavirus when, staff numbers are stretched as much as possible, is there still a place on a golf course for somebody who is, putting up bird boxes, beehives, compost, etc.? Are they luxuries that really teams can't afford anymore?
The majority of conservation greenkeeper of the year winners tend to do the work in their own time anyway. You mentioned beehives then. That probably wouldn't be part of a greenkeeping task at all at any golf course. I could be wrong, but I don't think it is. Bird boxes. There's a great guy at John O'Gaunt Golf Course. He spends the majority of his time checking the bird boxes, ringing the birds and so on. So I feel that it's still entirely doable. It's probably not doable to manage the, let's say, wildflower areas, cut and collect in the early spring when all this carried on. So they've probably been left, and they might not be as good this year as they should have been. But I don't feel it could be an issue. No, not really.
No. Okay. Well, as you know, as somebody who does visit a lot of golf courses, what are you thinking would be the benefits of this? You know, benefits is the wrong word, but what do you think would be the upside towards things?
The upside is definitely what John was talking about before, rewilding. Golf courses, if they're down to three staff, they just can't cut that rough, as John mentioned before. So rough is where all the mayflies live. Mayflies feed the birds. There's all sorts of different saprophytes live in the decaying timber in the woodlands that you can't clean up. So yeah, it's just, I think golf courses are going to be going upwards in terms of wildlife management, because we can't get in and do as much as we could have done if we weren't on the furlough.
Fair enough. Do you, how do we spread that news? Is this something that we, maybe yourself should be doing, or Biggish should be doing, or?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. But when I visit a golf course, I haven't been to many lately because I've been furloughed, obviously. But when I go to a golf course, I always make the time to put something on Twitter, something fantastic the golf course has done. John's, for instance, he's got some fantastic wildflowers behind the greenkeeper's facilities that feed the birds, the pollinating bees. So that goes out on Twitter. In terms of Bigger shouting about it, we do. We have the final page in the Bigger magazine, the GR magazine, that highlights the great work that greenkeepers are doing. And on occasion, probably three or four times a year, we have a full feature, full four-page feature on the great work greenkeepers are doing. In terms of people, individual people shouting about it, let's get everything out on social media we can. If we do any great work, anything we find, a rare bird on a golf course, an orchid, a rare wildflower, or something like this, get it on Twitter. Send it to me. I'll retweet it out, and then I'll send it to you, Colin. You can retweet it out via Biggest 20,000 followers. But we could always do more, but we're doing plenty.
Is it though? You mentioned that people do it as a hobby, and is there more a requirement? Is it becoming more of a requirement? You know, we've got less pesticides, so we need to look at more natural ways of managing courses anyway. Is the conservation side of things something that we really need to be looking at more often as an industry?
We mentioned starlings earlier on in this our conversation. Starlings are on the RSPB's red list of endangered birds. Now, you might think, well, I saw 100 starlings this morning on the field adjacent to my house. You probably did, but in the 60s and 70s, you may have seen 6,000 or 7,000 starlings just starting on the start of the field, working the way through, taking the leather jackets out, any worms that come to the surface, chafer grubs. They love these kind of things. And they just leave a tiny, tiny little hole like this, nature's aeration. The numbers have dropped significantly since the 60s and 70s, mainly to do with pesticides, DDT and so on, but also loss of habitat. Now, if we're creating more habitat for these birds, and we get more starlings and oyster catchers and things like this onto our golf course, then that's nature's pesticide. That's nature's way of dealing with the imbalance that perhaps we've created. Is there more shaper grubs this year than there was last year, or the year before the majority of pesticide got banned? Yeah, probably so. We don't have anything to deal with them, you see. We don't have any 10,000 starlings to come and sort these baddies out. We will do eventually, but it'll just take time.
John, what's your motivation, John, for doing this? I know you do more than just leave the rough. You do other things, as we mentioned, a lot of composting, etc. What's your motivation behind doing it all?
I think as sort of land managers, whether that's greenkeeping, farming, whatever you do, look after your local football pitch. I think you've got a duty of care, really, to do the utmost for that site, and whether that's sort of I think ecology and sustainability and managing that in the best practice is really important. And if you want to go home and sleep at night and think, God, I've made a difference and I've done a really good job, obviously starting with the site and how it's managed and best practice, especially with the environment in mind, is it's a sort of a duty really to anyone. And if I was sort of a member of my local Bowling Green, and for example, and they were, you know, planting certain hedgerows and doing certain activities, putting up bee boxes and the rest of it, you'd be proud that was getting managed in the right way and with the right processes. So I feel as though it's a duty for us and my staff as well at Warrington. We're very lucky that we've got staff that are very committed and very passionate about wildlife in their own right without it being a golf course. So, I think with the publicity of sort of global warming and CO2 and plastics and all the rest of it, I think it's becoming such a... It's in everyone's mind frame now about the environment and about wildlife, and it is getting publicised a lot in the media. So it is fantastic it's fantastic to have the opportunity to be able to impact on a site in a really good way. So I think it's a duty of care, and I think it'll be nice that when I've finished that I can feel as though I've left a positive footprint on a piece of land.
That's very admirable. Because you guys are Golf Course of the Year in terms of environment. Give us something that, say I'm a course manager coming out of COVID, coming out of coronavirus, I'm stressed, but I'm thinking there might be something that I can do that saves costs, saves time, that could also have a positive impact upon my environment. What sort of things should I be looking to do?
Yeah, well, the easy one is obviously you want to surround yourself with good people, but that's harder to do than what it is. But there is lots of initiatives that you can do. Just a couple of simple ones that we had, that we started last year. We've got four ponds on the course, and a local sort of fishery got in contact with us, and we now utilise these four ponds on the course to breed fish, and that brings in £800 a year income now for the club, which is fantastic. Obviously, there's the benefit of having the fish in there, cleaning up the ponds and the algae, and obviously adding to the food chain and the wildlife in our area. So, okay, we've had to do a little bit of work tidying up around the ponds and making sure the access into them's clear and the rest of it. But we're actually, it's gaining us an income and improving the wildlife and diversity on the site with very little input from the staff. Another one was we have a clothes bank on the course on the facilities, which we recycle a lot of the clothes from our department, but also members can bring in clothes and recycle clothes, and that generates £400 a year as well. And it's just obviously, and that clothing then gets recycled, and then it was going to Africa as well, a lot of clothes. So it's sort of simple stuff which actually generates an income.
The two examples I've never heard of before of a golf course doing. So
So there's a lot of payback you can get on the site. Yeah, so from utilising your land, and improving the footprint.
John, the ponds, when you said you have to tidy the edges, you've just made a small amount of access. And also, did you have to change the pH of the water or anything to do with the water? Or did you just put the fish in?
So there has been two of the ponds, we've had to line them to neutralise the water. So the fishery company, well, the fishery it's actually a water consultant who runs this for us. So he also tests our waters free of charge as part of the process. So he's a water specialist. So he takes them water, he samples them and takes them away. And as part of that, he obviously wants to create the best environment possible for the fish. So yeah, so we've been liming some of the waters and improving the water quality in the process. Yeah. So that's sort of another kickback, I suppose, from the whole process.
Yeah, sure. And the size of the ponds, they've have they been tidied, or have you left 2/3 of the size of the ponds for wildlife?
Yeah, well, they were fairly naturalised anyway, the ponds. Hmm. So we haven't actually had to do a lot of work in them. The main work we had to do is in one of the ponds. There was some branches that had fallen in, and they do need netting at some point in the ponds to then get the fish out once they've bred. So we need access to be able to pull a net across the pond. So there was a little bit of work involved in that, but the banks and everything to do with the ponds are naturalised. Yeah,
excellent stuff.
Yeah, James, is there anything you'd add to that? Anything that course managers or greenkeepers might think about doing at their course to help them out during this time?
Think about doing, yeah. Leave areas for wildlife. Very simple. You don't have to go berserk, just leave them for wildlife. So that's helping the greenkeepers who are perhaps stressing, thinking, oh my God, look at all this rough, it's a foot high now. That's fine, leave it. Explain to the golfers the reasons why it's there. A, we just don't have the manpower to do it. And B, the amount of wildlife that's going to grow and live in there and breed and be part of the food chain is hugely significant. So that would be my advice. Don't worry about the long rough growing. Leave it for wildlife for this year, then we'll work on it next year.
Do you ask for permission, or do you just do it and ask for forgiveness afterwards? How does that work?
What, the growing of the long rough?
Yeah. Do you need approval? And would you recommend getting approval first, or would you?
Well, yeah. I think it's probably best to speak to the secretary or the chairman or the captain or something like this. Or again, going back to social media, get something on social media, the reasons why we've got this long roof. Mm-hmm. A, we're down on manpower, and B, because we've got lots of wildlife milling around in there. Who knows what you might get on the golf course now? You've got the naturalised roof areas. So, yeah.
You went to Warrington yourself recently, didn't you? What really stood out for you from your visit there?
Stood out for me is the amount of excellent woodland management that's gone on, and the amount of decaying timber that John and the team have started to incorporate in the woodlands. They haven't just burnt it, they haven't just given it away or sold it off. There's a lot of decaying timber in there, which is hugely important. We've got a group of insects here in the UK, I think I mentioned them earlier on, saprophytic organisms. I mean, this could be anything that eats decaying timber. It could be an earwig or a wood lice or a bird. A bird could be described as a saprophytic insect organism as long as it uses decaying timber. And the amount that John's got on site is admirable. It's to be applauded. Another thing that stood out for me was the fact that John's and the team are moving away slightly, correct me if I'm wrong, John, from fossil fuels. You're moving towards battery-powered chainsaws and strimmers. Does that sound right?
Yeah, well, we're trying to reduce fuel consumption across the whole operation, really. Yet, so all our, a lot of the chainsaws we use now, the strimmers we use, the blowers that we take out are all electric. We have an autonomous mower as well, which mows an area around the maintenance facility. That costs us about £14 a year in electricity to operate it, and it cuts about 1,000 square meter area, and then we can just let that go, and the area looks fantastic now. The quality of how it's maintained is far superior than we would ever have done that without the robotic mower. Yeah, so we use electric utility vehicles, hybrid mowers. We have electric battery-powered hand mowers from Toro. So, yeah, every, everything we look at now going forward and that we want to replace, we're looking at it from a sustainability point of view and economically.
Do you think they perform against fossil fuel, let's say a strimmer or a chainsaw or something like this? Do they have the same amount of power? Can you work for 6 or 7 hours with one of these, or are they still lacking, do you think?
Well, as the technology's improving and the batteries are getting better, which is happening all the time, obviously there's now lithium batteries out, and they're definitely a step up from what they've had before. So yeah, as I'd say maybe when they first were launched 5 years ago, that there was a slight difference in the quality wasn't quite as good on the trigger time, whereas now they're so much more comfortable to use. There's a lot less vibration in operating as well. So now I think a lot of the arboriculturists and a lot of landscape operations outside of golf, they're all moving to electric now. They're all moving away from fossil fuels. And obviously golf is following suit. I know a lot of courses now are using electric strimmers and some of the electric blowers.
Okay.
So when it came to purchasing that, you obviously had to put together a business plan to convince the club that this was the right way to go, I presume. Did you explain to them how long it would take for this investment to pay off? What sort of work went into that?
Yeah, well, some of the larger purchases, the Toro hand mowers, they're about £15,000 each, so that's for three of them, you're looking at £45,000-£50,000 investment. So obviously you're putting a case forward on them, and with us, the main selling point for the club was the noise issue. We do have, as I touched on before, we do have local residents, and we do have noise restrictions that we can't make any noise by these properties before 7 a.m. So to be able to buy certain mowers that would allow us to mow the greens before 7 a.m. was a massive plus for the club and for us and for the team. Obviously we've never had to put fuel in these, and we've had them 5 years now, and they're running off the same battery just fantastically well. So when we hand mow greens, it's costing very little compared to obviously what other clubs would be paying. Right. So the payback's been fantastic with them, even servicing. You don't have any service costs with the electric. Obviously, there's just they reboot the computers on them and upgrade the software rather than us having, which costs nothing compared to yearly service costs, which may be £300 a year for certain machines, at least.
I don't know what the air quality is like in Warrington, whether it naturally matches up to York or Blackpool, but I imagine not sitting on a machine that's spewing out fossil fuels must be quite pleasant, actually.
Exactly, yeah. So that's another benefit for the team as well, yeah, especially strimming and using the blowers. We still have a couple of sort of petrol strimmers and the rest of it, but the lads just don't use them now. They just jump straight with the electric mowers, the electric strimmers and the blowers. So it's sort of, they've sort of by design that we're using them more now.
The only thing I will say, Carl, is being an ex-greenkeeper, you can't warm your hands on the exhaust pipe of a battery-powered mower. It gets pretty cold in the autumn and winter time.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah, but I'd rather be out there than, you know, than stuck in an office. So I do envy you guys.
Better gloves you can buy now, James.
There you go.
I've been out the industry for a while, so good.
since you're a greenkeeper, James. It's obviously the conservation is a year-round thing, isn't it? It's fair enough talking about, you know, beautiful wildflowers, etc. But John, it sounds like you guys, would it be fair to say that everything around the course is orientated towards this now? To the
everything we do is obviously part of our mindset would be how sustainable is this operation and what's best practice. So for instance, just the little thing, sort of in the winter, the heaters would be on timers. We wouldn't just be switching the heaters on and off and have them on all day while no one's in there. So this might save us 10p a day, but it's just something, it's good practice. So all the heaters in the drying room, in the maintenance facility, would sort of come on 15 minutes before the guys start the breaks, and then it would end as soon as the guys finish the breaks. So the use of sort of electricity just for simple things, obviously that there is a lot of thought process that goes into it, but once everything's in place, then it sort of looks after itself. But yeah, everything we do, we sort of look at best practice.
And where's that positioned you in the golfers' eyes and the members' eyes? If I'm presuming you tell them about all these things that you're doing, do the golfers view you differently as a result of that?
Well, it's not something we do just for publicity or just for the members. I think it's what you should do if you're managing a site, no matter if we were a members club or there was just one person playing. It's how we operate, really. So it's we like our department to operate in a way of doing things obviously the best way anything can be done, really. So but because we have had national recognition from the work we've done, that's obviously passed on, and a lot of the members are aware of what we do now. And we were lucky to feature in Today's Golfer last month as part of a sustainability issue. We've been in a lot of magazines, the local newspapers. So a lot of the members, I think at first thought it was a bit of a fad, maybe some of the things we were doing and didn't really understand it. But I think now a lot of the members are extremely proud of that. They can say, oh, Warrington have their own honey, and Warrington have won awards. So it's sort of, I'd say it took two to three years before it was fully embraced, before they understood that it wasn't just, we weren't doing it just for a Twitter feed or social media. We were doing it as best practice and not for publicity either. We weren't really, the first couple of years, I wasn't really interested in entering the Environment Awards even, because we were doing stuff anyway. I didn't really buy into it so much that it was for an award, but obviously being part of the awards help publicise what we're doing on a wider platform. So it wasn't really about winning, it was more about putting things out there for hopefully to inspire other people in other clubs.
Brilliant, that's great to hear. That's, you know, that spreading the message is fantastic. James, I'm going to come to you. A bit of an opportunity maybe to plug your own services at Bigger. If you're a course manager, I'm not as switched on as John, but I'd like to be. What are the first things, and it might be ringing, the answer might be giving you a call, what are the first things that I should be looking to do?
Well, you're actually perfectly right. Give me a call. If you're a Bigger member, give me a call, send me an email, send me something on social media. I might be able to help over the phone. If not, part of your course manager deputy package is for me to visit the site at some point, half day visit and an in-depth email. That's part of your Bigger package. If you do enter anything a little bit more significant, I'd be on site for a couple of days, then we do charge. But to get started, I do actually like to work more with the clubs who don't really do anything. They just get me in like, what should we do over there, James? All the trees have grown together. Well, the tree needs a little bit of management. How about growing in the rough over there? Do you need some wildflowers over here? Should we get a breeding bird survey on the go? Let's have a look at which insects you've got. And you can do a lot of this, believe it or not, in just a half-day visit from myself. I can give you plenty of advice in that half-day visit and the associated email. So just give me a call. If you're a Bigger member, give me a call. Easy as that.
Brilliant. And how can they get hold of you on Twitter?
Well, the Twitter handle is @ecology1bigger. My phone number is 07767 242863, and my email is james.hutchinson@bigger.co.uk. Did I say them slow enough?
We'll repeat them and share them for everybody. John, sure. you've had a visit, John, from James. What's he like in a professional capacity?
Yeah, well, one of the first things when I started at Warrington just over 5 years ago, I'd known James for a couple of years before, and one of the first things I'd done was to get James in just to give us an independent sort of audit and survey of the site. And he carried out a hole by hole audit of the site, just to see where we were and any quick wins we could get, and that was fantastic. And that was obviously before James joined Bigger, and that was when he was more obviously working for himself at the initial process. But yeah, I think starting out, just having some help and someone to call is important. No one's experts. Everyone's got something to learn. You know, I'd say in the infancy of what I want to learn to do with environmental management. So it was just nice to have James come in, get familiar with the site, and then if we did have any queries, it was great to be able to just pick up the phone and say, "Listen, James, we're thinking of putting some bat boxes up. What bats do we need to look at? What type of bats?" You know, there's loads of things where you're not sure of. And if you're going to put time into this, you might as well do it right. So it's just, as I touched on before, surrounding you with good people. And James was instrumental in the first year in helping us kick things off, really. And then since then, as part of Bigger, James has come back in and he's done a number of visits through Bigger now as well. So that first audit is, I think we've got 2 follow-on reports from that now in the last 5 years to sort of keep us in check and make sure we're on the right path. But I think it's more, the important thing is it costs very little, and it's nice to have someone on the end of a phone that you can just call and just get, even if it's just for 30 seconds or 2 minutes, "James, I'm thinking of this." It's reassuring, because it can be a lonely industry, and it is nice to have you back, I feel. And obviously James does this with everyone. It doesn't matter if you're the best ecologist in the world or someone just starting out. I think, yeah, James takes people as he finds them, and it's actually more about the wildlife than the course and the individual, which is right.
You've touched on something quite interesting there, John. If you were to say to me, and I hope Jim Croxton is listening, if you were to say to me now, "James, can you come and do another full audit? We'll give you X amount of cash," I would probably say, "Are you sure?" Because you guys are at a point now where you really don't need that much of advice from outside industries. You're doing fantastically well by yourself now. You've got to a point where you've got some great staff working for you. They know tons about woodland management, grassland management, and so on. You yourself are really educated and switched on lad. So I probably question why you would want one from me. And I love to hear this kind of thing, that guys who started out 5, 6, 7 years ago are now at a point where perhaps they phone me up for a chat or come in for a coffee or something like this, happy to do that. But they don't really need any advice from me, because they've got themselves to a position where they're doing great. They're actually winning awards now. So I like to hear that, John.
Yeah, well, I think it's sort of, obviously we're a bit further down the road now from where we were over 5 years ago. And it's nice to just obviously have someone that you can call on to just maybe just pop in and have a look at something that you're not sure about, rather than us having to get a full ecology rundown. So yeah, I think things obviously progress, and it's just a case of refining things now, really.
Because you're an award winner now, John, so you are one of those leading lights in this thing. So if people have, I've asked James for his contact details. If anybody wanted to get in touch with you and ask you any questions, how could they get in contact with you?
So probably the easiest way is on Twitter. So it's at JohnMack150 on Twitter. Or if they just follow Warrington Golf Club, then they can just message Warrington Golf Club and I'll pick that up as well. So, yeah, that would be the easiest way.
I will just sorry to butt in, Carl, as I'm back on furlough on Monday. It might be that I'm not available to answer any queries for the next, well, for the foreseeable future. So if anybody does get in contact via Twitter or wherever, I'm not ignoring you. It's just I can't do much about it at this moment in time.
Who's picking up your emails, James?
I'll send them to you. I'll send them to you from here in, yeah.
I'll send them to you and we'll build to me. Send them to me and I'll build a case for you. All right, gentlemen, thank you very much for chatting. I appreciate you taking the time to do this. James, thank you very much for coming on. I appreciate you've had a very busy week. And John, I appreciate you're very busy with golfers back on the course and things hopefully returning to normal. Thank you very much for taking the time to do this. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in today to listen to this Continue to Learn Extra webinar. I hope it has been interesting and informative. We've got a whole host. We have done ever since this COVID-19 pandemic kicked off. We really ramped up the digital offering to you guys and members. There's a whole range of webinars coming up in the near future. And everything that's happened over the last few months, you can check them out by accessing the bigger website. They're in the resources section. Just go to the website, search Continue to Learn Extra. Whole load of resources on there from Continue to Learn last January for a couple of years. So it's really worth getting on there, checking out. Don't forget to subscribe to the Green Room podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, and pick up the next edition of Greenkeeper International when it comes out. Okay, gents, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Carl. Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers, Carl.
The Green Room Golf Course podcast is produced by myself, Carl Hansel, on behalf of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. For questions, comments, and concerns, you can get in touch with me by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. You can also join the conversation on social media using @greenroombigger. And we've also got a Facebook page where all the latest notices, news releases, and information from Bigger can be found. We're also on Instagram using @bigger_HQ. Subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding they will have about the hard work of Bigger members and other greenkeepers. And speaking of Bigger membership, if you're inspired by what you hear to progress your career in greenkeeping, then a major first step is signing up to the association. The opportunities for career development are countless and potentially life-changing, such as volunteer opportunities at major tournaments and educational opportunities across Europe and the USA. Don't forget, if you're a golfer and you've got any questions about anything you hear on the podcast, have a conversation with the greenkeepers at your club. They've got the expertise to explain what's happening at the course and how it fits into the team's long-term vision to improve playability and enjoyment of the facility.